From the first lesson this morning, there the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up." St. Paul's vestry met this past Tuesday. For those of you who don't know what a vestry is, it's the elected governing body of the parish responsible for overseeing the parish's finances and property and ministries. We covered a lot of ground at last Tuesday's vestry meeting. I won't go into all that we did because minutes of vestry meetings make for boring sermons. However, one thing I will share is that the vestry sets some priorities for the work that we're going to undertake in the time we have remaining in this transition. We ended up with five things we want to pay particular attention to. I'll share the complete list in a future edition of the Thursday's e-news, but this morning I want to talk about just one of them, and it's this one. Parishioners said that they wanted St. Paul's to strengthen the process by which members are called and equipped for ministry and leadership. Well, when I think about what it would take to strengthen such a process, I think about creating a plan, you know, deciding on the outcome we want and then work backwards until we have a step-by-step plan for what St. Paul once called equipping the saints for the work of ministry. That's all well and good, and such a plan would probably result in the desired outcome, but there's a different way to go about this, and it's a way that I learned about during a vestry retreat many years ago. The retreat was led by a priest named Jim Hennessian, an old friend of mine. He baptized our two younger kids, and he was part of a clergy support group that I still belong to. Jim's retired in South Carolina now, but he was rector of the Church of the Redeemer in Cincinnati for 25 years. Redeemer is one of 10 churches that's featured in a book by Diana Butler Bass called Christianity for the Rest of Us. It's a terrific book about mainline churches that are thriving while most mainline churches are in decline. When Jim became rector of the Redeemer in 1979, it was a dispirited, failing congregation. When he left, it was an active, growing church with two services being offered simultaneously in separate worship spaces every Sunday and a serious commitment to serving its neighbors. And 20 years now after Jim left, Redeemer is still thriving. Well, I asked Jim to come and talk about empowering lay ministry during a day-long retreat with the vestry of the church that I was serving at the time. Now, you'd think that Jim would come and teach us techniques about how to get people to do the things that the church needs to get done. After all, doesn't empowering lay ministry translate into something like getting more people to teach church school or recruiting them to work on the stewardship committee so that they can help with the every member canvas, or persuading people who know about money to serve on the finance committee? Well, if Jim had taught us those sorts of techniques, the phrase empowering lay ministry would have meant how to twist the arms of your fellow parishioners. That's an understanding of empowering ministry that's far too common in the church. What Jim did with us instead was to get us to think about these questions. Where do I meet God? Where is God in what I'm doing? How is God calling me? It's his belief that what ministry is what we're doing when we meet God. Now, if you stop and think about this idea for just a few minutes, you begin to see what a radically different understanding of equipping the saints for ministry this is. Ministry is what we do when we meet God. At the retreat, Jim had the members of the vestry find a partner. He then asked each pair to find a quiet place somewhere and spend 20 minutes together. He told us to take each other's hands and to pray for each other, and then, one at a time, to share a God moment with each other, a time when we'd experienced God in our lives. And after 20 minutes were up, he asked us to come back together and share those stories. Now, my guess is that if I asked you to do something like that, like what Jim asked the vestry to do, you might feel a little uncomfortable. Sharing when you have experienced God in your life with somebody you don't know very well is outside of most people's comfort zones. And it certainly wasn't anything we did in the Episcopal Church I grew up in, where we didn't talk about our experiences of God and seldom even mentioned the name Jesus unless his name came up in one of the prayers that we were reading out of the prayer book. We were all surprised at the retreat, however, by how much we were encouraged by each other's stories, how uplifting they were, and how important it had been for us to learn about where each one of us had met God in our lives. Jim's belief was that most people have an experience of God, a deep, valid experience of the holy. And here's a story that he told us. Jim had a parishioner who was a scientist with the Environmental Protection Agency. This man's wife and kids came to Redeemer. He came too, not because he particularly believed in God, but because he thought it was important for the family to be together on Sunday morning. This scientist had a scientific worldview. He was steeped in the rationalism that scientists need to be steeped in order to do their work. For scientists, unexplained phenomena are not miracles to be amazed at. Unexplained phenomena are riddles to be solved using the tools of scientific method. So, on the Sunday that today's Old Testament reading came up about the burning bush, the EPA scientist came to Jim at the coffee hour after the service and said, "There's no such thing. A bush can certainly burn, but a bush can't burn without being consumed. I know about bushes, and I know about combustion. When something burns, it burns up." Not too long afterward, this scientist decided that it might be a good idea if he had a spiritual director, a person who could help him in his relationship with God and with his prayer life. Who knows what prompted him to do this? I blame the Holy Spirit, but who knows? Well, in Lent, the spiritual director assigned him the passage that we have today, the passage where God calls Moses from the bush that burns but is not consumed. The spiritual director told the scientist to read the passage and then take on the spiritual practice of looking for burning bushes everywhere in his life. The scientist protested, "But I don't believe this story. When something burns, it burns up." "Suspend your disbelief," the spiritual director told him. "Imagine that burning bushes can happen and then look for them. Just do it for 40 days in Lent and see what would happen." Well, at the end of the 40 days, the scientist came to my friend Jim and he said, "I never believed there were such things as burning bushes, but now I see them everywhere." In her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard writes about a book that she chanced upon called Space and Sight. After Western surgeons discovered how to perform safe cataract operations, they went all over Europe and America, operating on men and women of all ages who had been blinded by cataracts since birth. The book, Space and Sight, is a collection of the accounts of these cases. In response to reading it, Annie Dillard writes about several cases that she found in the book, how different people's perceptions were, how differently they saw when they first regained their sight than how we sighted people see things. One of the cases she writes about is the case of a girl whose cataracts have been removed. When the doctor took her bandages off and led her into a garden, the girl, now no longer blind, saw what she described as the tree with lights on it. Annie Diller writes, "It was for this tree I searched through the peach orchards of summer, in the forests of fall, and down winter and spring for years. Then one day I was walking along Tinker Creek thinking of nothing at all, and I saw the tree with lights on it. I saw the backyard cedar where the mourning doves roost charged and transfigured, each cell buzzing with flame. I stood on the grass with the lights on it, grass that was holy fire, utterly focused and utterly dreamed. It was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen, knocked breathless by a powerful glance. The flood of fire abated, but I'm still spending that power." She continues, "Gradually the lights went out on the cedar, the colors died, the cells unflamed and disappeared. I was still ringing. I had been my whole life a bell and never knew it until that moment when I was lifted and struck. I have only since very rarely seen the tree with the lights on it. The vision comes and it goes, mostly goes, but I live for it. For the moments when the mountains open and new light roars in space through the crack and the mountains slam. I don't know what Moses saw when that bush burst into flame. Moses was not a writer like Annie Dillard. He was the reluctant leader of people instead. But if I can't say exactly what he saw, I know the results of his seeing whatever it was that he saw. Moses returned to Egypt, faced down Pharaoh, and led his people from bondage to freedom. To use Annie Dillard's words, I suspect Moses' vision was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen. I suspect that God knocked him breathless by a powerful glance. And what I would say to all of us is this: there are burning bushes everywhere. We need to suspend our disbelief. We need to imagine that they can happen and keep looking for them. We need to look for them for the remainder of these 40 days of Lent at the very least, and then keep searching. If my colleague and friend Jim is right, we'll begin to see bushes flaming nearby whenever we're doing ministry in Jesus' name. Now, under no circumstances do I mean to apply that by the word ministry, I mean only the things that go on inside the walls of this parish church. Sure, I've had altar guild members tell me about the deep sense of the presence of God they've had when they've worked with holy things. I've had choir members talk to me about the extraordinary experiences of communion with God when they sing with other people. And I've had more than one church school teacher tell me that they have seen God's face reflected in the face of a child whose capacity to love and be loved hasn't yet been stunted by world weariness and cynicism. But I've also had people offer stories about God's palpable presence while they were at work, how Jesus helped them in an especially difficult situation or guided them when they had a tough decision to make. These stories and stories like them are all stories of God moments, all experiences of God, moments when the bush was blazing but was not consumed. And if we are still having trouble seeing what the blind girl once called the trees with the lights on them, let me suggest a few places where we're most likely to see them. They are Lenten places. The places where the cries and sorrows of God's people ring in our ears, where the powerful use their power unjustly. There are still far too many places where we hear the cries of people enslaved by oppression, hunger, war, all of those things. God continues to have compassion on the sufferings of the least and the lost, and as he did a long time ago, God longs to lead these people out of their bondage and into new life. And God still calls to us out of the burning bushes to help repair the world. I can't say where you'll see bushes burning into flame. Maybe it will be praying when you're praying for the lives of those who have been devastated by the conflicts in Ukraine or the Middle East or any of the other wars. Maybe it will be when you attend Tuesday's Greater Cleveland Congregation Listening Series. Maybe it will simply be when you reach out to someone whose heart aches with loneliness. There are burning bushes everywhere. Let's keep our eyes open, because if we want to be equipped for ministry, a burning bush is a damn good place to start.